Good morning. It is good seeing you here on this still a little bit snowy Sunday morning. Thank you all for your prayers for me and my family, and earlier in the week for my mom. As many of you know, this has been a very, very crazy, nutty week for us. Actually, it's been a crazy 3 months since we've got here, quite frankly. It's been nutty. But this week was especially crazy, and it's weird today, quite frankly, preaching. Last Sunday, my mom was in church, falling asleep on my sister's shoulder. I don't know what that says about the sermon or my mom, but she was in church last Sunday morning, and this Sunday she's in heaven, so I say she traded up. But that makes for just a little bit of a weird Sunday. Pastor Andy offered to preach today. I said, no, you know, I think I want to be with you all, and you'll see this about me as we journey through life together. I just am what I am, and through my journey, I kind of take you along on my journey, and we kind of go through things together. And so I thought today would be a good day to even do that. It's been weird. As you know, last Sunday morning, we prayed for my mom, and here she was going to have surgery on Monday, which she had, and everything went great on the surgery. Monday morning is in Detroit, Henry Ford Hospital. The surgeon came out, told us everything went perfect. She had a valve replaced, another one repaired. They thought they were going to have to replace that one, but they didn't. They repaired the other one, and she had an aneurysm in there that they didn't know what to do with, and they ended up leaving it because they thought it was too small. And the doctor came out and said, everything went great. The surgery went great. Couldn't have gone better. Your mom is doing terrific. He said, you'll be able to see her in about an hour. And so we are still waiting in the waiting room, waiting to go up and see my mom. And about an hour later, a different doctor came and said, something went horribly wrong. We don't know what happened, but your mom's heart stopped. And so they wheeled her back into the operating room and began to try to get her heart going again. They weren't able to do that. They hooked her up to a machine, an ECMO machine is what they call it, they were hoping that her heart would just kind of kickstart on its own. And so for the next couple of days, I was hanging out at Henry Ford Hospital. In fact, a lot of this sermon was written while I was hanging out in room 548 in the Henry Ford Cardiac ICU. You know, sitting kind of at the foot of her bed while doctors and nurses and family and everybody else was coming in. And I was working on this a little bit. So it's made for an interesting week. As you know, then 2 days later, we unhooked that machine and my mom peacefully and quietly went to heaven. But, you know, it's different. My mom's passing is different from others. Her passing, we put a little obituary in the Detroit papers that will be in there, I don't know, yesterday or today or something like that. Her funeral's tomorrow. And it didn't make headlines. It's just this little obituary that you put in the news. It's not like other people when they die, famous people. You know, last Sunday, one actor died who was an Oscar-winning actor. And when Philip Seymour Hoffman died, you know, that made news. Every newscast carried that story, and it was a tragic death. You know, allegedly it was overdose of heroin. Terrible, tragic. In his family, no doubt today, his funeral I think was on Friday, and no doubt his family is still grieving and suffering over this tragic, horrible, terrible, really waste of life. We don't grieve that same way this Sunday morning over my mom. The Bible tells us, Paul in 1 Thessalonians says, brothers and sisters, we don't want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died, rose again. So we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him. We have tremendous hope. Every single Sunday, whether it's Easter or not, every single Sunday, we are celebrating that good news, the resurrected news. We are proclaiming that Christ is risen. Now, that's your cue when we say that on Easter. You're supposed to say he is risen indeed. And so we've got a little bit of teaching to do between now and Easter. But when you hear that in church, boldly proclaimed, I say Christ is risen, you say he is risen indeed. We celebrate every single Sunday, whether it's Easter or not, that Christ is risen. That's still pretty weak, but we've got till Easter to really get it down. And so it is different for us. We proclaim that Jesus Christ made all the difference, that we have hope when someone who passed away, like my mom, who had faith in Christ, that they don't, it's not the end. I've officiated at literally hundreds of funerals. And I tell folks usually at those funeral services that I'm not an expert on heaven. I don't know, you know, what it's like to walk on streets of gold. I can't describe for you the pearly gates. I don't know how deep the crystal sea is. I don't know any of that stuff, but I know this. My mom is there. I know that. I may not know a lot, but I know that. And the truth of the matter, we used to sing a song, and we don't sing anymore, old chorus, and you probably remember it. It will be worth it all when we see Jesus. Remember that? It will be worth it all when we see Jesus. What? Life's trials will seem so small when we see Christ. Remember that? One look at his dear face, all sorrow will erase. So bravely run the race till we see Christ. That's my mom. She bravely ran the race until she saw. Well, she last few years, she hasn't been running any races. Well, she's never ran a race. So she bravely shuffled the race until she saw Christ. But you get the idea. You know, she's in heaven. She's experiencing all the joys, all the glory that God has for her. Well, okay. This is at my mom's funeral service. That's tomorrow. You know, we're in this sermon series called Clean Hearts. And I think what I've experienced this week will really actually help us as we talk about this series where we're at. Next week, by the way, here's your commercial. We're beginning a new series called Neighbors. And I'm really excited about that series. We're going to talk about what does it mean to be a neighbor and who's our neighbor and how can we reach out to people and what's it mean to be a good neighbor. Not talking about State Farm, but what's it mean to be a good neighbor. That's all next week. But today we're in Clean Hearts, which was really a series based on Psalm 51:10 and Psalm 51 in particular. And we looked at it last week as David, it's his response. Psalm 51 is David's response to his horrible, rotten, terrible affair that he had and the whole cover-up and the whole mess. And David's really, Psalm 51 is David's confession to all of that. David knew he had sinned. He knew that God had blessed him and had given him victory after victory after victory. And yet he turned his back on all that and he sinned. And it was horrible and rotten and awful and deep and dark. And so Psalm 51 is his response. It's a confession. And David, unlike so many people that I know, when they have sinned, instead of running away from God and trying to move away from God, David did not do that. He ran toward God. And he prayed in Psalm 51 those words, "Have mercy on me, O God, and wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Cleanse me with hyssop and I will be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Create in me," our key verse, "create in me a clean heart," or "a pure heart, O God. And renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence or take your Holy Spirit away from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me." And that was David's prayer. And God answered that prayer. And God came and did what David prayed. He did renew his spirit. He did recreate his heart. He renewed his hope and gave him new life. Everything he prayed for, God did. God gave him another chance. God will give you another chance too. God's in the business of giving second, third, fourth chances. And at the end of David's life, when the commentator in 1 Kings is writing about David's life, you know, back then, Old Testament kings were put into two categories. There were the good kings and there were the creepy kings. And for the most part, most of the kings, quite frankly, were the creepy, weird, evil kings. And so they were put in those two categories, those who did right in the eyes of God, those who did wrong in the eyes of God. And David, in spite of that sinful, terrible time in his life, the commentator in First Kings said, "For David had done what was right in the eyes of the Lord and had not failed to keep any of the Lord's commands all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite." That whole thing, it was that moment of sinfulness did not define who David was. Rather, he was defined by the grace and the forgiveness and the mercy of God. He was defined by his confession, really. He was defined by how he moved forward from that terrible, horrible, sinful past. He was defined by what God was doing in his life. And I thought about that as I was going through all of this stuff with my mom, and I thought in many ways that's my mom as well. Tomorrow at the funeral service, my mom's life is defined by what God has done in her life. My mom was not perfect. She worried. She was a great worrier. She worried about her son, my driving, which maybe she had reason to worry for that. But she worried about, And she worried about whenever there was a snowflake in the, if there was a snowflake in the air, then that meant the roads were an icy death trap. You know, she just would not travel on snowy, icy roads, or even if there was that snowflake there. She worried about her kids and grandkids. She worried too much. She was not an athlete. I told you, she never threw a football. She never ran a marathon. She never did any of that. She will never be known as a great culinary expert. My mom was kind of a meat and potatoes kind of lady. And back when I was a kid, that was before, at least before we had a timer on our stove. And so sometimes that meat and potatoes was a little burnt. You know, we had long-winded preach. Every Sunday growing up, we had roast beef for dinner. I don't know why that was, but every single solitary Sunday, we ate roast beef for dinner. And you know, sometimes the preacher preached too long, or she would have trouble finding where all, you know, I have two sisters and a brother trying to find where all of us were, so we would seem to always be the last one home. So frequently, we had, you know, burnt sacrifice for dinner on Sunday morning. That's just the way it was. And when Carla and I got married, she made a roast beef for me one time. And the first time she made roast beef, and I kind of turned up my nose a little bit at it. And she noticed. She said, "What's wrong?" I said, "Well, Carla, it's not hard on the ends like it's supposed to." She said, "Well, it's not burnt." I said, "Oh, who knew?" You know, my mom wasn't a culinary expert. She was gullible. My mom was so incredibly gullible. Every April Fool's Day, I would do something to her. One year, my freshman year at Olivet, I don't even remember what was going on in the world, but something, you know, some crisis was going on. So I called her up on April Fool's Day, and I said, "Mom, I'm just so upset about what's going on in the world." And I went down to the recruiting office, and I joined the Army. And my mom, she didn't try to talk me out of it. She didn't try to engage me in conversation. This was what she said, and I quote, "Don't move. Click." And 5 minutes later, my dad called from work. And he never called me from work. My dad called from work, and he was laughing. And he said, "Rob, you have to call your mother. I've been on the phone for 5 minutes trying to convince her that it's April Fool's Day, that you did not go and join the Army, but she won't believe me, and you have to call her." My mom was so gullible. She wasn't perfect. But tomorrow, you know what? We're not going to be talking about the mountains she didn't climb, or the things that she did not accomplish, or her imperfections. We're going to be talking about what God had done in her life. And the fact that God had given her, like David, a clean heart and a renewed spirit, a steadfast spirit, a sincere, deep, real faith. That made all the difference. She's defined by that, not by all these other things. She was defined by what Jesus had done in her life. And that's what David is talking about. David prayed, "God, recreate my heart and renew my spirit." David was defined at the end as a king who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord in spite of that situation with Uriah. My mom will be defined by what she accomplished in Christ, what Jesus did in her life. And the question for us is, how will you be defined? When is your time to go? When the preacher stands before your family and friends, what will the preacher say about you? Will they be able to have that same confidence like what my brother and I are doing the funeral service tomorrow? We did my dad's funeral service 5 years ago. And we're doing my mom's tomorrow. We'll be the ones officiating. What will the preacher say about you? Will he be able or she be able to have the same confidence that we will have with my mom? I heard one story, maybe you've heard the story, it's an old story, about these two notoriously evil, rotten, horrible brothers that lived in this one town. They were businessmen and they had made a bunch of money by swindling and cheating and lying. Well, one of the brothers died. The other brother went to the preacher who was supposed to be officiating the service and said, "Listen, I want you to say that my brother was a saint tomorrow in the service." And the preacher said, "Well, boy, I don't know if I can do that. Everybody in the whole town knows your brother was a swindler and a liar and a cheat. I don't know if in good conscience I can say that he was a saint." And the brother said, "Listen, I don't care how you do it, preacher, but I want you to do it. In fact, I'll give you $50,000 to your building fund if you say my brother was a saint." The preacher said, "Oh, well, let me think about that." So the day of funeral came, you know, and he didn't know how he was going to, within good conscience, say that his brother was a saint, but he sure wanted the $50,000 for the building fund. And so this is what he said. He said, "The dearly departed was a swindler, a liar, and a cheat, but compared to his brother, he was a saint." That's so dumb. Point is, what will the preacher say about you? How will you be defined? Will they look at you and say, there is a person that was faithful and true, a person with a clean heart? Not perfect, but one where God's grace was abundant and God was faithful and true. See, that's really the question is, what will be your legacy? How will people define you? You know, Henry Ford was defined by cars, and Thomas Edison was defined by light bulbs, and James Naismith was defined by basketball. Billy Graham defined by preaching the word. My mom, we'll define her as a sincere, real, true faith. What will your legacy be? How will people define you? See, a legacy isn't something you just come up with the last year. My mom was 81 years old. You can't just come up with a legacy, you know, your last year or two. It's the course of your life. It's the direction you take. It's what consumes you. I want to be like the guy in Jesus' parable, one of the shortest parables that Jesus told. It's only one verse in Matthew 13. Matthew 13, one verse parable. Jesus says this: the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field. And when a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy, went and sold all that he had and bought that field. Back in those days, there wasn't a bank on every corner like there is today. It seems like, you know, Genesee County has a bank on every place, and so you can put your money wherever you want. But back then, it wasn't like that, and banks weren't secure like they are today. There's no FDIC. In fact, banks were quite unsecure. You know, nations would fight against nations, and they would overthrow countries, and the banks would go to whatever the new country was, or robbers and thieves would come. And so banks weren't all that safe. And so what frequently happened is people would bury their treasure in a field. They would just stick it in the ground, and that was safer than putting it in a bank. The problem with that investment strategy is that, you know, sometimes that the owner of the field would be called off to war, or he'd forget where he buried it, or he would just die and not tell anyone where the money was. And apparently that's what happened in this story. The field was being plowed by this farmhand, and this treasure had been buried there who knows how long, maybe 10 years, maybe 100 years, maybe longer. And so this farmhand, not the owner of the field, but the farmhand who was just tilling the field, was out plowing, and he hit something, must be a rock, and he went around the front to kind of get rid of the rock, and he realized it wasn't a rock. Ha! Yahoo! My lucky day! Hidden treasure. But of course, that treasure was owned by whoever owned the field. So he looked around. Anybody see? No one's seen. His heart's beating, you know, a million pounds a second. He reburies it, goes, finds the owner of the field, and they agree on a price for the field. But in order for him to accomplish that, the only way he could buy that field is if he sold everything he had. He has to liquidate all of his assets. So he sells his house, his ox, his cart, his stuff, his furniture, his clothes, everything. And his family thought he was crazy. What are you doing? Why are you selling everything? Hey, why are you selling that shirt? I got you that shirt last year for your birthday. I like that shirt. Hey, you're selling that picture on velvet of Elvis. Why are you selling that? You're selling all your treasures. But that guy knew something. We know it. That field was worth everything. It was worth everything that he had. It was worth everything to him. And Jesus is saying that's how we need to be. That needs to be our legacy. That the kingdom of God, that being in a right relationship with Christ is worth everything. Even if it means giving up everything, it's worth everything. That's how I want to be defined. That's the legacy I want to have. I want to be known as someone with, like David, a clean heart, a steadfast spirit, one who was sold out for Jesus Christ. That's what I want my boys to know about me. That's what I want the legacy to be. What will be your legacy? What will people be saying about you? You know, it's interesting for David. You know, he was very, very wealthy king. His son, Solomon, would take that up to a new level, but he couldn't buy a clean heart, and he couldn't earn a clean heart. The only way he could get a clean heart is if God did a work in him. His father, Jesse, he was a godly man, but he couldn't get a clean heart just because of Jesse. It wasn't just transferred from Jesse to David. You know, my parents, I've told you, my dad was an alcoholic. My parents were not Christians. And then when they became Christians, they were sold out for Jesus. But they couldn't transfer their faithfulness onto me. That had to be a decision I made. In fact, frequently, I think you can make a case biblically that there's from generation to generation, there is a downward spiral from godliness to godlessness. And now it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way at all. But frequently, that's the way it goes. From godliness to godlessness. Look at like Abraham. Abraham could be described as righteous. Abraham was committed. Abraham was a friend of God, the Bible describes him. Abraham's life would be described by, if you could come up with a word to describe Abraham's life, it was he did right. He did what was right. But Abraham's son was Isaac. And if Abraham was described as he did right, Isaac's life could be described of as he looked right. And there's a big difference between Abraham and Isaac biblically. And you want to know what it is? Whenever Abraham went someplace, the very first thing that he did was he built an altar. And then right after he built the altar, he dug a well. Isaac changed that just a little bit. He would go someplace, and the very first thing he did was dig a well. And then he built an altar. Just a little bit, a hair difference, but it turned into a big difference. So if Abraham did right and Isaac looked right, Isaac's son was Jacob. And Jacob was so confused and perplexed. And I suppose he could be described as saying, what's right? He didn't know. And you read through the book of Genesis and you'll see the confusion and how Jacob is always getting into trouble and doing this thing and that thing. He didn't know who he was and how he believed. It was a downward spiral. Well, another biblical example, you can look at the children of Israel, Joshua. Joshua, a man of strong and courageous, the Lord will be with you wherever you go. Joshua knew the Lord, no doubt about it, committed, just like Abraham, committed. He was committed. But the next generation, the children of Israel following Joshua, it describes them, the Bible describes them as Joshua was one who knew the Lord. That next generation was one who knew about the Lord. There's a big difference between knowing the Lord and knowing about the Lord. And in Judges chapter 2, the next generation says they did not know the Lord and they did not know the works of the Lord. See, there's this downward spiral. See it in David's life. David, a man after God's own heart. A David who at the end of his life, his legacy, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He did not, you know, fall away from what God had planned. David was a man after God's own heart. Psalm 42:1 says, as the thirsty deer pants for streams of water, oh, my soul pants for God. David wrote that. Said, I want God. I want all of God. I want to be about God. That's my desire. David could be described as being priority-minded, this clean heart. David was on fire for God, and he wanted to know God, be with God, see God, work in his life. David reminds me of a new Christian. You ever see a new Christian, when they become a Christian, they just want all of God. They just are so excited about what God is doing in their life, and they just want all of God, and so they're on fire for God. They come, when they're a brand new Christian, don't know anything about Christianity, they just know that their life was a mess, and then God transformed it. They don't know a lot of stuff. They don't know, you know, are they amillennialists or premillennialists or post? They don't care about that junk. They just want to serve God. And I preach, turn to the book of Isaiah. They can't find Isaiah if their life depend on it. That's okay. They just want to serve God. God has done such a transformative work in their life and where they were and where they are. And they're just so happy. You know, they're not mad at anybody. They're not caught up in church politics. They just want to serve God. That's great. That reminds me of what David was. He just wanted to serve God. But then Solomon, his son, you know, if David was described as a clean heart, Solomon could only be described as a compromised heart. And Solomon saw his dad, saw how God worked in his life, saw the blessings that God had done in his life. But Solomon, growing up in the temple, he became very materialistic, very self-centered. If you were to read Solomon's writings, Ecclesiastes chapter 2, Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes. And in the first 11 verses of chapter 2, we're not going to read that this morning, but you can go home and read it. First 11 chapters, or 11 verses of chapter 2, there's 46 times Solomon uses a personal pronoun. I did this and I want that and I want to have this and this must be for me. It was all about himself. For David, it was all about God, serving God. Even when he sinned, even when he had that horrible, terrible, awful sin, what he did, he turned to God, he ran to God and said, you've got to take care of this because I messed up. But you won't read that in Solomon's life. David was a clean heart. Solomon was a compromised heart. And Solomon had a son, Rehoboam, who's probably the most messed up king that ever sat on the throne of Israel. Conflicted heart. See, it happens. Now, it doesn't have to happen. There doesn't have to be this downward spiral, but so frequently it happens. The first generation is on fire. The second generation is less on fire. And the third generation totally throws up their hands and don't even remember. It happens. And so for we parents, it should be an issue of warning for us that we need to do all we can. We can't transfer our faith. My parents didn't transfer their faith to me, but they certainly modeled before me what Christianity and what serving Jesus is all about. See, it's awfully hard to tell your kids that God is number one in your life, and then they never see you praying. It's awfully hard to issue all sorts of platitudes about how great God is and how wonderful God is and how you're a wonderful Christian, and they never see you reading your Bible. It's awfully hard to tell your kids that God is number one, and they never see you writing out a tithe check, never see you involved in mission, never see you really do anything for God. It's awfully hard for that. What they'll see is what Solomon saw, or what Rehoboam saw in Solomon. That what you say is one thing, what you do is something else, and where that leads is to a very perplexed, conflicted place. So it should serve as a reminder. My parents weren't perfect. They are certainly not perfect. But they were consistently following Jesus Christ. And when they said they loved Jesus, there's not a one of us kids doubted that they loved Jesus. And when I talked to my mom on Monday morning before she went into surgery, and she was talking to me about how she was in church the day before and how they prayed for her and how she was confident that God was going to work, and there's not a person in our family that doubts that. We knew exactly where she was. Why? Because what she said and what she did lined up. And if we want our kids to be the same, we've got to, what we say and what we do needs to line up. What will your legacy be? Will your kids say, he was like that guy in the field? He was all out for Jesus. Nothing else mattered but Jesus. That was the treasure, and he had it. Or will they say, well, they said one thing, but boy, by their life, it was something different. It doesn't have to be a downward spiral. In the book of 2 Timothy, Paul's writing his last letter. He's writing to Timothy. And in that letter, he tells Timothy, at the very beginning, during his greetings, salutations, he says, I thank God, whom I serve, as my ancestors did, with a clear conscience, as night and day I constantly remember you in my prayers. Recalling your tears, I long to see you so that I may be filled with joy. He just so loved Timothy. And then he said this. This is the part I want you to get. I'm reminded of your sincere faith, which first lived in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I'm also persuaded now lives in you also. My mom had a sincere faith like Lois. She didn't transfer it to me. I don't get it just because she had it, but she modeled a faith before me and my brother and my sisters, a sincere, real, deep faith, so that we know that her first day in heaven, she realized her worrying days were through. My question for you is, what will your legacy be? Will your kids, your grandkids, have that same confidence that we have with my mom?